Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 7th of March, and Susan Jacoby is our guest this hour. Her book is now number 3, and I'm happy it is. There is so much in it. The book is The Age of American Unreason. Susan is the author of 7 books, including Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, and Wild Justice, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. She's a consultant on programming for the Center for Inquiry, New York City. It's a rationalist think tank. She's a frequent contributor to national magazines and newspapers, one-time writer for the Washington Post, and she also does a blog there, which we will hear about. This book looks at so many things. It looks at the words that moved her 40 years ago as a college student, and those words were found in Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, published in early 1963, and this book has been reviewed as a book that updates that and has the same kind of influence. She looks at the revolutionary generation, the presence of genuine intellectuals. She talks about what's happened to our thoughts about intellectuals over the past 40 years. She looks at casual colloquial language. She looks at Don Imus. She looks at email. She looks at the current crop of presidential candidates. She looks at the anti-rationalist movement in this country, which has been politicized from the bottom up and the top down. She looks at fundamentalist religion and so much more. She looks at emails and correspondence and letters that she found that she wrote years and years ago, and it makes you want to read all of those letters as well. It's terrific. Here's a story about how the book came to be written. We'll find out if it's true. It's detailed in the New York Times book review of her book, The Age of American Unreason. She's walking home from the New York Public Library on September 11, 2001, overwhelmed and confused, stopped at a bar, and while sipping on a Bloody Mary, listened to two neatly dressed men in suits. For a second, she thought they were going to compare that day's horrifying attack to the Japanese bombing in 1941 that blew America into World War II. "This is just like Pearl Harbor," one of the men said. The other asked, "What is Pearl Harbor?" "That was when the Vietnamese dropped bombs in a harbor, and it started the Vietnam War," the first man replied. And at that moment, Susan said, "I decided to write this book." We'll be welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hello, Susan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi. I'm glad to be here. Wisconsin Public Radio has always been good to me. And yes, the story is true, but it's not in the book, and I didn't put it in the book because it doesn't sound as if it's true. It sounds like it's made up. That's what I told the New York Times reporter. It's not in the book because I thought this sounds like it's made up.
Yeah.
So I didn't put it in the book.
Well, I figured it was true because it was in the review, and I thought, I got to use it. This is just too good a story to not use.
The reason it's not in the book is it's one of those things that sounds like you made it up.
Right.
And in fact, a light bulb didn't go over my head. I think, oh, got to write The Age of American Unreason. I just, you know, like most writers, I record a lot in my mind. And I thought, I need to think about this some more on another day.
Yes, exactly. Well, I'm glad you thought about it and thought about it long and hard you did. There's so many places to start. Why don't we start? Because it is the foundation of the country. You talk about one of the most remarkable characteristics of America's revolutionary generation was that there were so many genuine intellectuals. Thank God for that.
Yeah, it wasn't a word that was used at the time, by the way. It's not a word that anybody used. It sort of has 19th century European origins. But by intellectual, I mean simply that they were men. They were men of books and learning who did a lot of thinking. And I think more important, the men of the Enlightenment didn't see any contradiction between thinking and doing. In other words, they thought it was a natural thing to both be a thinker and to be a political doer. And I think one of the things that has been lost over time, and particularly the last 40 years, is there's another idea which is somehow it's embodied in the idea of them that can't do teach.
Right.
Well, that's an idea that really would have been anathema to the founders of this country.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about John Kennedy. You spend a bit of time on Kennedy in this book, believing that we had a need in this society to return to that 18th century model in which learning and a philosophical bent were thought to enhance political leadership.
Yes, I mean, Kennedy himself, I don't think that any professional politician can really be a true intellectual. There's not time for it. But he was somebody who had great respect for learning and for intellectuals and brought a lot of them into his administration. I think even more important, what Kennedy didn't know, he had a healthy shame about. I mention in the book Kennedy's visit to France in 1961. Kennedy couldn't speak a word of French, and he was embarrassed about that. So he used his wife, Jackie, as an interpreter with Charles de Gaulle. In other words, he had respect for people who could speak a foreign language. George Bush, whom I think is a symptom, not a cause, of our debased intellectual culture, goes to Paris in 2002, and he has a joint press conference with President Jacques Chirac. And NBC's correspondent David Gregory, who does speak fluent French, asked Chirac a question in French. George Bush just puffed up with rage, and he said, "The guy memorizes four words, and he plays like he's intercontinental." That's a direct quote. What exactly it means, I leave to your imagination. But it's unthinkable, for instance, that any European president would reprimand a European foreign correspondent for speaking to the president of the United States in English.
Right, exactly. Instead, he's saying, "You show off, don't do that."
Yeah, you show off, right. Yeah. You must be putting on an act because you're speaking to some foreign leader in his own language.
Right. How does this whole era, what's happened in the last 40 years, contribute to what you talk about? In your previous book, you were asked to go, and I'm sure you're doing speeches all over the place on this book, and you're finding that in your audiences, everybody already believes what you believe, or people who listen to Rush Limbaugh already believe in their ditto heads what he tells them to do, and they believe what he believes. That we're so polarized here that we find our own little camp, and we don't, as we did in other times, appreciate a different point of view.
Well, see, that's an interesting question, and in a way, it's the essence of incuriosity. That's right. People used to, in the 19th century, for example, devoutly religious people listened to Robert Ingersoll. He was known as the great agnostic, very well known in the Midwest. They listened to his lectures on evolution and on agnosticism. He was known as the great agnostic, not because they agreed with him, but because they wanted to see whether the devil really had horns. What we have now is a culture, and it's a culture very much fostered by segmented media. We have a culture in which people seek out and listen only to people they already agree with. And this is true. I know serious conservatives have found this to be true on the lecture circuit, just as I have, that their audiences consist mainly of people who already agree with them. This is less true of The Age of American Unreason than of my previous book, I think because I have a lot to say in this book that offends both the left and the right. So I'm getting more argument from my audiences, for which I'm grateful.
Evolution. Americans alone in the developed world and their view of evolution by means of natural selection as controversial rather than as settled mainstream science. And we might be able to add global warming to that as well. How could this be?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. You know, it's tempting to blame it on fundamentalism alone. And that's certainly a big factor, which is about a third of Americans believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible, which is something, this again, in any other developed country, this is unheard of. It's entirely possible to be religious and accept the scientific truth of evolution if you're the kind of religious person who sees the Bible as a divinely inspired metaphor. But you can't believe literally that the earth was created in 6 days and accept evolution. So fundamentalism is a factor, and fundamentalists have a lot of influence in areas in which they're strong, on school boards and what's taught in schools. But then there is, I think, something larger, which is, I just said that a third of Americans believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible, but two-thirds of Americans believe that both creationism and evolution should be taught in public schools. So in other words, a much larger percentage of Americans believe that both of these things, one of them a religious theory based on books written thousands of years ago, and the other science, should be taught in school. Well, what accounts for that? Well, I mean, first of all, poor education. Our level of science and math education is quite mediocre. But then I think also it's something Richard Hofstadter said, which is still true today, But the media is much more influential today than they were at Hofstadter's time, is the tendency of the media to present everything as if there are two sides to every issue, which is true in some instances, but in others there is in fact a right side and a wrong side. And what the media tend to do is present everything in terms of truth somehow must be equidistant from two points. And so when a lot of Americans say both creationism and evolution should be taught in science classes, they're acting as if creationism is something with scientific validity. Creationism can be taught in history of religion classes, but it shouldn't be taught in science classes because it's completely scientifically invalid. The place for it is in a cultural history class.
Well, even the President of the United States believed that intelligent design should be taught. What does that mean?
Well, intelligent design is just creationism packaged in a new form, that's all. Intelligent design doesn't necessarily say the Earth has to have been created in 6 days. What it says is that everything in creation was designed by God to result in man. So it also is a religious theory.
Right. But what is the significance of President Bush making that statement?
The significance of President Bush making that statement is that somebody who believes that could be elected. I think I've gotten into arguments with some radio talk show hosts, in fact, in the past couple of weeks, who've asked me, don't I think that Bush is responsible for the dumbing down of America? No, I don't. I think that Bush and the kind of anti-rationalism he represents is the result of the dumbing down of America. Americans elected him. You can't say that George Bush concealed, as far as I'm concerned, he might have ignorant and proud of it stamped on his forehead. So you can't say that Bush concealed who he was from Americans, that he lied to people about who he was and what he believed. We think it's okay to have a president whose administration, in fact, has done many things that are at odds with science.
What would you think if you heard him say nuclear instead of nuclear one of these days?
Well, I think the quote elites had gotten to him, but you'll never hear him say nuclear instead of nuclear because he can't. It's embedded in his genes to say nuclear instead of nuclear.
You spend a fairly long chapter, and I had never thought of this before. Actually, the use of the word "folks," once a colloquialism with no political meaning. Invoked recently by public officials in the 21st century, which you call a debasement of public speech. Oops, hello. I think we lost Susan somehow. That just went up in the air. We'll have to call her back. Susan Jacoby is our guest, and she does spend quite a bit of time talking about casual colloquial language, which she also says she believes conveys an implicit denial of the seriousness of whatever issue is being debated. Talking about folks going off to war is the equivalent of describing rape victims as girls. Look up any important presidential speech in the history of the United States before 1980, she writes, and you will not find one patronizing appeal to folks. It's a fascinating chapter, and we'll talk to her more about what that means. Susan, we just lost the connection here somehow. So
technology
folks.
Is not perfect.
No, I guess it's not. It's like the phone just evaporated.
Yeah, we were just cut off.
I know. The use of the word folks.
Yes. First of all, folks is a perfectly good colloquial language, usually used in rural areas in the Midwest and the South. It was like guys or kids. It was something that was appropriate for the playground or the bar. It is not anything before 1980 you would ever have found in dignified public speech. I mean, just imagine, we highly resolve that these folks shall not have died in vain, that this government of the folks, by the folks, and for the folks shall not perish from the earth. There's a reason. Now every day, whether it's television anchors or all the political candidates do it, and what it is it's an effort to say that I'm just one of the boys, I'm just one of the girls. It's patronizing. I don't believe for one minute that Hillary Clinton ever uttered the word folks before she started running for the presidency. I don't believe that television anchors, utter the word folks all the time in their own home. It is a way of trying to say, I'm not one of the elites. I'm not better than you are. Mm-hmm. I'm one of the folks, as if all of us go around using it anyway. But there is a relationship between that kind of address, saying that I'm one of the boys or girls. Do we want political officials who are one of the boys or girls? Maybe we do, but it's very, people don't even realize when words like this invade the public square that they were not usual when presidents were trying to talk about matters of seriousness until quite recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm so happy you included in the book Robert Kennedy's speech in Indianapolis after the death of Martin Luther King, and there's a lot to that, and we're going to play a part of it. It gives us a chance to play part of it, too, and then take phone calls. Susan Jacoby is our guest. Her book is The Age of American Unreason, just published by Pantheon, number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Continuing Susan's discussion about the use of language, Chapter 11 in her book is titled Public Life, Defining Dumbness Downward, and we'll spend some time on the use of language here and the relationship between politician and audience. She writes, on April 4, 1968, Robert F. Kennedy had just arrived to deliver a campaign speech in Indianapolis when he learned that Martin Luther King had been assassinated in Memphis. Kennedy's aides urged him to cancel the speech, but he decided to deliver the tragic news himself to a predominantly black audience.
I'm only going to talk to you just for a minute or so this evening because I have some very sad news for all of you. Could you lower those signs, please? I have some very sad news for all of you, and I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in.
And it also, we don't have the part of the speech in Indianapolis in which he quoted Aeschylus. It almost makes me cry to hear that again now, and I'm so glad that you write about that, Susan.
He went on right after that to quote Aeschylus, "Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart until at last, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." Hmm. Nobody would quote from a classic like that today. They'd quote from some pop song or something like that. They would never quote from something, never respect their audiences enough to recite the words of a Greek tragedy written thousands of years ago. We'd never hear that today.
Mm-hmm. And he addressed the audience, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
Yeah. And ended with, which let us dedicate ourselves to that, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world. I love that as well. And say a prayer for our country and for our people. And now it's always
God bless America.
God bless the United States of America.
Which is different.
Yes, it is different, isn't it? It's very different. So obviously, you know, in a crass sense, that worked for him. It worked for that crowd. It calmed. There was no violence in Indianapolis that night, and there was violence in cities all over the country. And people understood what he was saying, and they got the depth of it from Aeschylus, too. Why wouldn't we continue on along those lines?
Well, first of all, Robert Kennedy was the product of an older speaking tradition and an older education. I think that basically politicians have been dumbed down by the same media that dumbs us all down. And they actually think that if they sound too uppity, too better than anyone, and I think they're making a misjudgment, by the way. I think that people maybe are hungry for leadership that tries to elevate them instead of says, I'm just folks like you. But we've heard a lot in the last few weeks, for example. One of the most depressing developments to me was when the Clintons went after Barack Obama, who, although he uses folks too, is a speaker of a much higher level than we've become accustomed to.
Yes, he is.
And basically what they're saying is he talks too good, and that this is somehow at odds with practical solutions. And again, this is actually out of an old American anti-intellectual playbook, which says is that you must distrust the person who speaks too well, and that there is some kind of an opposition between being a thinker and being a doer.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them. Susan Jacoby is our guest. Her book is The Age of American Unreason. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And Reed from Clintonville is our first caller. Hi, Reed.
Good morning. Thanks for this opportunity. Your discussion has sort of taken a different tack than when I initially called, but I guess I would like to say something to the effect that, you know, our country as a whole seems to have lost its intellect or intellectual integrity in that, and going back to the last hour's discussion also, the country has seemed to have invested their interest in electing third-rate or perhaps in some cases fourth-rate political hacks or incompetents or trainees. I'm sorry, I apologize. I just sort of lost my train of thought here because I had waited so long on the phone. Doing that through celebrity rather than through intellectual integrity. And, for instance, an example is the woman that called last hour and said that Mr. Obama knew as much about the goings-on of the pre-war discussions as Hillary Clinton, and he did not. He was in the Illinois State Legislature and was not privy to anything.
What is your question?
Well, my question is, why do you think that the American public is so willing to listen to
100 third-rate orators? Okay, let's just take it from there, Susan.
I don't think that was what was about to be his question. I think you should take another question because this really was not a coherent question. And I think but I do think that our educational level has to do with the fact that we don't demand enough evidence from all of our politicians. Again, I think the politicians are a reflection of this. They're not a cause.
You, on the other hand, are not entirely dissatisfied with the current crop of presidential candidates.
Well, I don't think anybody could be dissatisfied with the current crop of presidential candidates compared to what we've had for the last 8 years. But we'll see what happens in the general election. I certainly do see with Clinton and Obama a lot of degeneration into not talking about issues at all, but I have more experience. He doesn't have any experience. You did this. You were silly enough to dress in an African headdress the way every politician does when they're in a foreign country. I'm hearing less from them about issues now and more about personalities too.
Let's go to Ray from Eau Claire. Hi, Ray.
Oh, good morning. Thank you, Kathleen.
Sure.
Thank you, Susan, for coming on Wisconsin Public Radio. You mentioned the little bar scene with the Vietnamese bombing Pearl Harbor, and immediately triggered that old John Belushi college fraternity satire comedy, Animal House.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where he's ranting about the threatened closing of their fraternity and trying to motivate his fellow fraternity brothers and saying, did we take this when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor, and of course, two of the fellows turn to each other and say, "Germans?" And I just wonder, Susan, how well that would pass for comedy now, a full generation later. Would people even recognize the satire?
That's an interesting question. We have some brilliant satire on late night TV every night on Stephen Colbert and The Daily Show. And here's why I think it's a good question. I can't tell you when the Colbert Report came on how many people I argued with who thought that he was the right-wing conservative he poses as.
Oh my.
That's the character he plays. And I can't tell you how many people, educated people, were unable to recognize that this was a satirical character he'd created. And I think this also has to do with the triumph of the video culture over the print culture. I think that anybody who had read enough would have been able to recognize this as the satirical performance that it was. In many ways, we have a culture which is just connected to the fact that we don't read everything. We don't have a very broad background against which to judge things. And this affected, that is a very good question, because this affects our ability to analyze the media before us as well as our ability to look at political candidates.
You cite in the book the study from the NEA that shows how few of us have read a work of fiction or poetry in the last year, or read a nonfiction book.
Yeah, I was going to say what it is about half of people under 44 haven't read any book, and by that I mean any book, any book at all—a self-help book, a bodice ripper romance, anything at all. Now, I have been criticized in print and in interviews for ignoring the explosion of reading on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I make no bones about it, and I'll take my lumps for it. What we do on the internet is not reading, really. What I do on the internet, I love the internet. It's a great tool. I no longer have to look through 10 books to find out some dates that I've mixed up in my head. But that's what it is. It's a tool. Reading, what we're doing on the internet, most of us, is when we're not looking at people throwing up on YouTube or in chat rooms, they're obsessing about profiles on MySpace, is we're looking for chunks of information. You know, we're sort of swooping down like vultures and looking for chunks of information. And the internet is very useful for that. But it's not reading. Reading is something more. Reading is connecting yourself to a larger body of knowledge and experience. And information and knowledge are not the same thing. The internet is a great source of information. It's a better source of information if you've acquired the knowledge to judge whether the information is true or false.
Let's talk about emails and letters. I was fascinated by, and I think you ought to publish these at some point, the letters that you found to your fiancé, an African correspondent for Africa,
Dream
correspondent
on.
For Washington Post. They'd be interesting. And also the letters to intellectual letters to a gentleman from England, I believe. I can't remember his name.
Philip Vellacott.
Yeah.
The great
yeah.
translator of Aeschylus and Euripides.
And these were wonderful. This doesn't happen very much anymore. And then you talk about the difference between email, where people don't write that way. But tell me about finding those letters. What a great thing to find.
Well, it's part of the loss of the print culture, and this predates emails. The loss letters were a very important part of intellectual life. Really until the late 1960s. I don't frankly know what biographers of late 20th century figures are going to do for source material. But letters really began to go out of fashion when long-distance phone rates dropped. That's fact. I don't have any significant numbers of letters from good friends around the world after 1970. The letters I referred to with my friend Philip Vellacott, the translator from England, well, he was in his 90s when he died. So in other words, he wrote letters because that was the way he was raised. But I think email is to true communication by letter, and to real conversation, by the way, also, spoken conversation, as the information is on the internet to the larger world of knowledge. Email is an abbreviation. Now, there are exceptions. There are people who do write long, discursive
yes.
emails. But it's rare. Most of us don't, because email is an informational form of communication. Even from friends, the emails we usually get are usually emails apologizing for having been out of touch for so long. Do you notice that?
Right, right.
Hi, I've been out of touch.
Right.
Just wanted to check in. I'm not dead yet. but email kind of encourages you to condense things in the shortest possible form. It's the nature of the medium. The medium is not just the message, as Marshall McLuhan said. The medium determines what messages we send, in a way.
I love emails, though. I love to get them and send them. I just find something.
Do you really?
I really do. No, I mean, I get a lot of junk.
I like them at a time like this because emails from old friends I've been out of touch with for years are turning up.
Right, right.
But most email I don't like because I have to wade through dozens of emails, you know, of junk before I can get to the ones I want. So email is something that takes a lot of our time.
Yes, it does.
It certainly is not a time saver.
Right.
Because most of the email, I love the occasional email from somebody I've been out of touch with and thrilled to hear from.
Mm-hmm.
But most of it is a chore.
Mm-hmm. The other, I can't remember if it was somebody in the subway or it was a cab driver when you were having this marvelous conversation with Philip about Greek philosophers, et cetera.
That was in the subway. We got trapped in the underground at some point in the 1980s in New York. Actually, somebody had jumped in front of the train and committed suicide. And we were stuck there for about 15 minutes. And Philip, who of course survived the Blitz in London and was not upset by being in enclosed spaces, he was talking to me sort of in this conversational tone. I had told him I hadn't read any Euripides till I was in my 30s. And he said, how wonderful it was when you were in your 30s when you first met Euripides. He said, I met my wife when I was in my 30s. It would be like falling in love at a time when you're old enough to understand it. And there was this kid next to us, and he was listening to us. And as we finally, they let us off the subway, he looked at us, he said, man, listening to you is a blast, he looked at him. And I thought about this, and I realized, if we had fast-forwarded 10 years, he would have had his earphones in his ears, and he wouldn't have heard a word
we
were saying.
Right. Thanks, Ray, very much for the call. Let's go to Sheree from Fond du Lac. Hi, Sheree.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Number one, thank you, Kathleen, for doing the subject, and Susan Jacoby, welcome. I just wanted to, looking at the presidential candidates on the Democratic side, I don't think anyone can argue that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton lack any intellectual thoughts.
No.
I think that what it comes down to is maybe common sense. So I kind of want to know what the difference is between intellect and common sense and whether or not intellect can get in the way of some common sense decisions.
That's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
There is a difference between intellect and common sense. Common sense is more what I would call judgment. I don't like the term common sense because too often people equate it with say that there's some opposition between common sense and intellect. There isn't any opposition between judgment and intellect. You know, which is to say that the more educated you are, the more you know, it doesn't necessarily give you good judgment. But it also, if you do have good judgment, the more you know, it can add to your ability to judge. In other words, what I'm saying in this book is the idea that there is some opposition, and this actually is an anti-intellectual idea, that there's an opposition between common sense or good judgment and learning. There isn't. But there certainly are a lot of intellectuals who don't have good judgment or common sense. And by the way, there's also a difference between an intellectual and somebody. I think you're absolutely right. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are both very smart, educated people. Very few politicians are intellectuals because intellectuals really do spend their whole life with books, and it's very unlikely that a politician today would be a true intellectual. But you don't have to be a true intellectual to be educated and have knowledge, and that's one of the points I make in this book. One man on another radio show called in. Actually, he wrote an answer to a piece I wrote in the Washington Post, and he said 80% of the people don't know anything anyway. And he said, I don't care whether my car mechanic knows where a rock is on a map. I only care that he knows how to fix my car. Well, I think that is the true elitist position. I do care whether my car mechanic and 80% of the Americans can find a rock on a map. Because if you don't know where a rock is on a map, if you don't know the difference between a Shiite and a Sunni, that is certainly going to affect and contribute to bad judgment about whether whether it's a good idea to send our troops into Iraq. Mm. And people ought to care whether high school graduates know these things. I'm not saying that everybody ought to have a PhD. What I'm saying is we need much wider respect and knowledge and better education for everyone. To say that you don't care whether your car mechanic knows where Iraq on a map, this is just the essence of elitism. It's absolutely not what this country was supposed to be about.
And you contrast that with FDR and his fireside chats, asking Americans to get maps of the world so they could find out what was going on with the war.
Yes, and a president could do that today. Google Maps, it's easier to access than to go out and buy maps in a bookstore. But the fact is, one, FDR could count on an audience of at least 75% to 80% of Americans for his fireside chats. He wasn't competing with 24/7 infotainment and iPods and YouTube. But I think a president must be able to educate the public, and there is no what reason a president could not do that. I'd like to see the next president just give the network executives a heart attack by preempting a lot of time for educational chats. But what they do is, what we've become accustomed to, are presidents who just announce something they've already decided. I'm the decider. That, too, is a stupid anti-intellectual saying. Now, the president should be the decider. He's not the only decider, and you don't decide without looking at evidence and weighing evidence, and it's a good idea to try and educate people as well, but you can't if you're a bonehead yourself.
Do you see any candidates, you talk about this, is there any evidence that any candidate has the will or the courage to talk about ignorance as a political issue?
No, you know, of course, somebody said to me, you can't say to people, you're idiots. But
right.
That's not the point. I think that there would be a place for a candidate to say, look, we have a problem as a nation, a knowledge deficit. It is a problem that extends from the smallest hamlet to Washington itself. As a people, we've become too lazy to learn the things we need to know to make sound public decisions. One of the objectives of my administration is going to be that we are all going to aspire to higher standards of evidence and learning before we jump into all kinds of public policies. And that goes for whether you're talking about a war or a new health care plan or anything else. I think that politicians wouldn't be lying if they said they didn't know enough either. I think that would be the way to approach it.
Susan Jacoby, our guest. Her book is The Age of America on Reason. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Susan Jacoby is our guest, and her book just published, The Age of American Unreason. We go next to Andrew from Amory. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, good morning. How's it going?
Okay, how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I'm so happy to get in and be able to ask my question. First, a little bit of background about myself. I am 21 years old. Resident of Wisconsin, and when I went through high school and now in college, I noticed that everything that we go through and everything we're taught is the standard stuff that you need to know, your standardized testing, and, you know, they teach us things, and I've noticed that they don't teach you to be creative, and we're not taught how to think for ourselves. And my junior year, I happened to have a teacher come along and tell me that I need to be open-minded the rest of my life, and I need to look at both sides of an issue before I made my decision. And my question is do you think the way our educational system is set up, do you think that is the reason why this is happening in America?
Yes and no. I know that sounds like a cop-out. I think that we have, to some extent, particularly in recent years with this incredible emphasis on teaching to the standardized test, I think that we've confused again little bits of information with knowledge. I don't think that the teaching of facts is opposed to critical thinking, but I do think that education beginning early on, and I think that focusing on colleges, there's been too much of it, because if people don't learn something in elementary and high school about how to think, how to evaluate things, I'm not sure that actually even can be corrected at the college level. But there isn't an opposition between teaching facts and teaching people how to think critically. For example, It's very well known through many studies that American high school graduates are completely deficient in their knowledge of American history. Many of them don't know that the Revolutionary War preceded the Civil War. Many of them think that the Constitution founded us as a Christian nation. They don't know anything about the First Amendment. Many of them don't know that the Constitution actually permits slavery, and that's why the Civil War was fought. Now, you need to think about American history in terms that weren't taught when I was in school. When I was in school, for example, what the Constitution did about slavery was passed over. But you also can't analyze why the Civil War was fought, why we have a heritage of racial discrimination and racism today, if you don't know the history, if you don't know that the Constitution did institutionalize slavery, if you don't know what led up to the Civil War, if you don't know why the Civil War was fought and when it was fought, if you don't know what happened after the Civil War when Jim Crow was institutionalized in the South, what I'm saying is that there isn't any opposition between critical thinking and facts. You need both of them. And the schools, frankly, are doing a lousy job of teaching both.
In our universities, we over the past 20 years or maybe even 30 years now have women's studies disciplines, African American studies disciplines. Does that keep the other more mainstream disciplines from looking at those areas as part of the general course of history?
Well, I think it has. This is one of the things I've been bashed from the left about. I think what happened in the 1970s after the anti-war movement, after the Black Power movement, after the feminist movement is a settlement was basically reached on university campuses, not on every campus, but on most of them. And what it was this: we will set up separate departments of Black studies, of women's studies, later on of queer studies, and so on. We will leave the core curriculum alone. Students who wish to study these other, I call it the multicultural studies ghettos, can do so. Well, this had two advantages. For the left, it created a whole lot of new jobs in the multicultural studies ghetto. And for the right on campuses, it left people, let's say, teaching who wanted to only teach dead white European males, it left them not having to change their ways. It is still as possible. When I graduated from Michigan State, I'm from the Midwest, in 1965, I'd taken a lot of history courses. I had never read a word of W.E.B. Du Bois. I had taken a lot of literature courses. I'd never read a poem of Langston Hughes, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It is just as possible for a student to graduate from Michigan State today without having been exposed to those things. To get exposed to those things at most universities, again, not all. There's some universities that have made multicultural studies part of the core curriculum, and that's the way it should be. But it deprives both minority students and majority students when we don't decide that a lot of these things, for instance, African-American history, as far as I'm concerned, is American history. And anybody who studies American history should not be able to get out of college without knowing plenty about so-called African-American history. But the way we have set things up is people who generally these subjects are studied by people planning to make a career in the multicultural studies ghetto. They should be studied by all things. I'm not saying there shouldn't be these courses. I'm saying they should be part of them should be part of the core curriculum and required for everyone.
Thanks, Andrew, for the call. Daryl from Delavan. Hi.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Daryl.
Susan.
Hi.
Good to hear your voice again, Kathleen.
Thank you, Daryl.
I just had a couple comments. I don't think it's polarization so much. I agree with Susan. It's education and our knowledge of what's going on in the world. It's not so much. I don't think it's polarization so much as just plain ignorance that's so common these days. And if you consider, you know, only 50% of our population has computers or access to computers. I mean, we can all go to libraries, but as you're saying, people aren't really reading. The young aren't reading, in particular, below 40. And the old are probably watching a lot of John Wayne movies. But I think we need a new paradigm of speech, a speech more efficient than what we now have. I have a couple short examples. If you consider money, it's a fool's banquet. We all take the bait. Sometimes it seems like a date rape, dark and erotic, yet forceful still. It's all contained on a dollar bill. And money lubricates our whole world. But most people sit, watch their big screen TV, and they're on vacation in Egypt, swimming in the river of denial.
Susan.
I don't know. Is that a new paradigm of speech? Money lubricates the world, and people are watching TV in the river of denial. I honestly don't know what he's talking about. Whenever I hear words like paradigm of speech, my ears begin to buzz. We need to talk better. We need to have more respect for words. This thing that he quoted, I mean, to me is ridiculous. And the problem isn't only that 50% of people have computers. The problem is how we're all spending our time. It's not that I don't think everyone should have a computer, but the computer, judging from what I see on blogs, is not providing us with a new paradigm of speech. What we need to learn how to do is talk well, period. You only learn how to do that from reading good books and hearing good talk, and you can't learn about it on MySpace.
What is everybody doing with their time? Are they listening to the iPods? Are they watching videos? What are they doing?
Look, time is the most important thing of all. I am not saying that people should spend their entire days reading Proust, as someone mentioned, nor should people spend their entire days playing video games. What's been lost is the kind of idea of moderation and balance, the idea that we need to learn from a lot of different sources to be intelligent. And one of the things we need to learn is that little condensed sayings, such as the caller just used, that is just as silly as the sort of thing you see on a TV commercial. It's the condensation of language is not a very desirable thing. I think we all need to look at how we spend our time. A couple of years ago, for an article I was writing, I'm one of these people who always used to tell myself I don't watch much TV. I told myself that because I'm always reading also while I'm watching TV. But when I turned off the TV, which I also turned off the video and the DVR and all of that, it was painful. I found out, in fact, just how dependent I was on TV, and it hurt. It hurt, just like giving up sugar hurts for a while. And then I discovered, as I started to read more without the TV on, how much I'd been missing in the books I was reading, because I was also half paying attention to what was on the screen. Well, now, I watch TV and videos. I don't watch nearly as many of them as I did before the TV turn off, because I also think one of the things, the idea that you can do things equally well when you're multitasking is wrong, and there's a lot of scientific research to show that. I think we all need to think more about how we allot our time.
So I don't understand. Were you watching videos on TV, or what were you watching on TV?
I was watching TV. I was watching everything from Law and Order to movies. And I'm not one of these people, by the way, who thinks that what you're watching matters all that much. I mean, yes, if I had a kid, I'd rather they'd watch Sesame Street than Friday the 13th. But I think what's more important to the dumbing down of America is how much sheer time we spend in passive entertainment, not exactly what we're watching, how much passive entertainment we're taking in, how much we're distracting ourselves from concentrating by doing all of these things at once, all of which involve video and audio.
Thanks, Daryl, very much for your call. Matt from Lake Geneva, hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'm really interested in the period in the late 18th century, early 19th century, where we had this intellectual ferment of the common man. Edmund Burke, the British parliamentarian, commented that people in America were reading Blackstone's commentaries, you know, that this was a best-selling book. This is a law digest. You know, people were trying to understand their circumstances vis-a-vis democracy and government. And this was a big debate, and people were really into it. And I think nothing scares the elites more than common people having a discussion about democracy. And I think, while I agree with you about this passive entertainment problem, I think that the industrial elites and the progressive intelligentsia in the later part of the 19th century, they combined to foist public education on a nation that was already doing pretty well at educating itself. because the public education system would be a way that they would tamp down this intellectual ferment democracy.
All right, Susan, your response.
Well, first of all, public education was actually a goal of American communities, really beginning in the colonial era. Foisting public education on people, very few people had access to education. But here's an interesting thing. Abraham Lincoln was our last self-educated president. He said that he had spent no more than a year of total time in school. He grew up very poor, and he regretted that deeply. I think that the idea that self-education is superior to organized education, first of all, they don't cancel each other out. But if public schools had not been greatly expanded in the 1860s and 1870s, and they were in large measure, by the way, a response to immigration and urbanization, we would have had populations who would have come here and never, for instance, learned to speak English. Would that have been good for a discussion of democracy? I don't think so. And moreover, the Gilded Age also gave way to the Progressive Era, and a lot of the people from the Progressive Era were also educated in public schools. So do I think that public education is a plot against democratic intellectual discussion? No. And one of the things, Thomas Paine, who is probably one of the greatest self-educated figure in American history, one of the things that was a big movement in early 19th century America were societies, lecture societies, by which people who had missed out on a chance for early schooling, which only the elite had then, had a chance to educate themselves later in life.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're plumb out of time. Thank you, Susan, so much for being with us. Susan Jacoby, our guest, and the book is The Age of American Unreason, #3 on the New York Times bestseller list. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Mimi Notstein for producing the hour, John Treader for on-air production in Milwaukee. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.